Welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, The Secret Psychology of Persuasion. My name is Natalie Nahai and I'm the web psychologist. I help businesses psychologically optimize their online engagement by applying scientific rigor to their design process. In The Good, The Bad and The Dirty, I'll be sharing strategies and tools with you that you can use to enhance your online presence. Listen weekly as I share new sites, news in online persuasion, and the occasional guest star to help you convert more customers online. Make sure you subscribe for free updates at thewebpsychologist.com and get all the resources we mention in the show on the show notes page at thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Good, The Bad and The Dirty. This week, our guest is Dr. Michael Wu, the chief scientist at Lithium, where he currently applies data-driven methodologies to... This week, our guest is Dr. Michael Wu, the chief scientist at Lithium, where he currently applies data-driven methodologies to investigate the complex dynamics of the social web. Michael works with big data and has developed many predictive and prescriptive social analytics with actionable insights. His R&D won him the recognition as a 2010 influential leader by CRM Magazine. And in addition to purely empirical methods, Michael also leverages design social principles that govern human behavior to decipher the intricate human components of social interactions. He's also the author of two business books, the e-books The Science of Social and The Science of Social 2, and he received a triple major undergraduate degree in applied math, physics, and molecular and cell biology, and has a PhD from UC Berkeley's biophysics program where he studied visual processing within the human brain. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure too.
So first of all, I have to ask, how does someone with such a diverse scientific background end up in the social web space?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of an accident because, you know, as I was finishing my PhD, I was just doing a little bit of a career exploration. And I was, you know, got offered a lot of jobs at places like, you know, that offers a scientist title. But when I talked to their scientists, I was a little bit disappointed because most of their scientists, their so-called scientists, their day-to-day work is actually very much like an engineer, which is great. But then, you know, that's not really what I was looking for. So I kind of was ready to go back to academia. And then my friend who was at Lithium at that time, you know, asked me to kind of look at their data and help them, you know, build some interesting stuff from that. And I, you know, they don't have any specific requirements yet, but so that sounds more like a scientist job where you could truly explore and kind of define your own problem and solve it your way. And so that's kind of how I ended up with Lithium.
Fascinating. So and we recently shared a stage at the Virtual Community Summit, which was amazing. It was hosted at the RSA in London, where you gave a fantastic talk about the science of sustained engagement. Can you tell us a bit more about this?
Yeah, so, you know, engagement, you know, as most people think, you know, it's typically, you know, engaging with a customer, and it's, most people think it's really hard, you know, but what people don't understand is, like, you know, the difficult part of our engagement is really the sustainability of it. You know, it's actually not difficult to engage with someone. You know, if you have a funny joke or a cute puppy picture or a game, right?
Yeah.
You can engage. Some people will engage. And actually, in fact, a lot of people will engage when you share those things. But the challenge is that that's not very sustainable.
Yeah.
If you do that like every week or every day with your friend, right? Pretty soon they're going to say, oh, it's the same thing over and over again. They're going to ignore it, right? So that's the challenge of, you know, engagement, is to sustain it over long periods of time. And it turns out that there's a, you know, there's a science behind, you know, how to do this in a way that it's actually sustainable. You know, and the key is really to build a strong relationship. You know, once you have a strong relationship, then engagement becomes long-term. You know, if you look at the people that you have long, kind of sustained engagement with over a long period of time, they're your friend. they're your family, they're your coworkers. Now, these are people who have some strong relationship with you. So that's mainly what the talk is about.
Fascinating. And you furnished it with so much really interesting research and so many examples that really brought it to life that I think it's kind of one of the first talks that I've seen that really tackles this head on and in an accessible but quite a rich way. You also talk about how successful brands must adopt a strategy that's scalable and sustainable. And the sustainability piece comes in quite a lot, but it's often something that gets overlooked. Why do you think it gets overlooked and why is it so important?
Yeah, because I think part of it is because most people don't think very long term, and they're afraid to think long term because things in the future is sort of uncertain, right? I mean, nobody can predict the future, so yeah, so that's something that we cannot do yet, but that's in some way where science can help you, because as a job, as a scientist, our job is to build models from data so we predict the future with some kind of reliability, right? We can't predict everything, but we could predict something, right? The fact that we could predict something means that we could take some of the uncertainty out of the future so you can actually think longer term, right? So, and the reason why this is important is because, scalability is really an illusion. You don't have sustainability, right? I mean, a lot of companies, they try to get big, right? But what if you get big? So what if you get so big that, but tomorrow you just being outcompeted by some of an incumbent coming up, as a startup that comes up, right? So it's kind of, an illusion. A lot of companies try to get big and they feel that it gives them a sense of security, but it's almost like a false security, because what they really want is sustain over a long time. That's what people should be really thinking about. And when it comes to social media is highly disruptive, and disrupted a lot of companies. And a lot of companies, are using social to scale. Even startups are using social to kind of scale really quickly. They can use Facebook to reach, 1 billion people, right? So everybody could do this, but then very few people think about social strategy that's actually sustainable over a long term.
It's funny because I found also in my own work, and when people ask about, how do you market yourself or build a brand or engage in that social way, especially when you're just one person, that the sustaining piece does become relevant, and it is something that becomes immediately apparent from the outset. So, if you're going to decide to blog every day, then is that something that you can continue to do once you take on clients, for instance? Or if you're tweeting 5 times a day, is that sustainable for one person versus another? And I think it seems to me that people who are doing things by themselves or in small agencies or companies do have to tackle sustainability and the question of sustainability much more early on
That's
than
right.
perhaps the larger organizations. Okay, so what are three things that you think that businesses can do to make their social strategies more sustainable?
Well, the three things I would say is one, we have a model on how to build a sustainable strategy, and that's really Geoffrey Moore's like four gear model. The four gears model basically says that, to be sustainable in the social world, you really need four gear. Whereas traditionally, business has been running under the two gear model, right? The four gear is basically acquisition, engagement, monetization, and then enlistment, right? So traditionally, business had been doing is that they what they've been doing is that they acquire customers, and then they want to monetize them as quickly as they can. It's a very transactional base, right? So that's two gear, right? But in the social world, business, as relationship with people is, tend to be become much, much more important, right? Relationship is the key. Social is about everything is about relationship, So with that, you need to have two more gear, and one is to engage with your customers, right? And then after you engage them, you can monetize them, right? And then after you monetize them, you have to enlist some of them to essentially help you, right? So that you can acquire more people more effectively. So that's essentially creates this feedback loop, right? So you go from, you acquire some customer's attention, so you engage them so that you kind of sustain their attention and focus on your brand for a while, right? So in, if you engage them well, they will actually be converted. So that means you can monetize. And then after that, you have to enlist them to kind of help you to acquire more, right? So that kind of creates this feedback loop, right? When you have this positive feedback loop, it becomes sustainable if every one of the gear is spinning at the right speed. So that's essentially a strategy for how to essentially have a sustainable social strategy.
And do you find that that model, Geoffrey Moore's four gears model, also works across other things outside of social?
I haven't thought about it too deeply, but I think it does. You know, I think the gear may be different. You know, so I think the Geoffrey Moore's model is more around. I would say, in my perspective, it's more around like, you know, the marketing efforts of a company. So it's basically when you're dealing with customers and. But I think when you're dealing with other things, I think the key about sustainability is look for this positive feedback loop, right? And make sure that every component of that positive feedback loop is kind of working, right? So there's no like a broken link that kind of breaks the chain, right? Or breaks the loop. When that happens, when you have a positive feedback loop that kind of where every component is working, then it automatically sustains itself. Just from the fact that it's a feedback loop.
So we've been talking about this model, which is, it sounds like a very practical approach for assessing what your social strategy is and whether it might be broken in certain areas according to those four gears, which is a wonderful assessment tool. But also, one of the other things that you mentioned in your talk is that obviously because the social web is based around relationships, is around how you can leverage relationship life cycles. So can you just briefly describe what a relationship life cycle is and then how we can leverage this to do better business?
Yeah, so, you know, the relationship life cycle is basically, you know, a way to look at relationship as they were developed and as they were, as they kind of end. It's a life cycle of relationship, right? How relationship began and how relationship that's kind of the life cycle, right? So typically, most relationships begin, you know, when people, you know, I mean, people are not born with their relationship, right? So they begin kind of disconnected. People are not connected to other people, right? And then the first step when you build a relationship is you create a weak tie, right? So which is fairly easy, right? You basically have to introduce yourself and say a little bit about yourself so that people remember you, know a little bit about you. And that's it, right? That's enough to create a weak tie. You have some weak association with that person, right? But the challenging part is, you know, how do you convert that weak ties into a strong tie? You know, that's where, you know, we as humans spend most of our time, you know, building relationship, right? Is in that stage. It's turning those weak ties into strong ties. And we do that, you know, pretty much throughout our life, you know, like, you know, as we work, as we meet new people, you know, it only takes a hello, a first meeting to establish a weak tie, right? But it may take like, you know, month, years, or tens of years to develop that weak ties into a strong tie, right? So that's, you know, how you know, typically, you know, people spend a lot of time there. But then what people often forget is that, like, after you have a strong tie, that's not the end of it. You know, that strong tie really needs to be maintained. You know, because if you don't maintain that strong tie, then it, after a while, it becomes a weak tie again. You know, then you know, it never really gets disconnected, but it just stays at the weak tie, and then you just kind of get lost and you get forgotten. So the strong tie needs to be maintained, and then, like, if you do not maintain it, then it becomes weak tie. And if you know, for example, do something really bad to your friends, then eventually you get disconnected, right? So you go back to this disconnected stage, right? So that's kind of, in essence, how, you know, the relationship works. You know, like, it's how it begins and how it ends. And the interesting thing about this relationship cycle is, where do you develop weak ties into strong ties? and where do you maintain those strong ties? We know that like creating a weak ties is really easy. Step one is really easy. Pretty much anywhere you can meet new people, you could create a weak tie.
Mm.
But then to build those weak ties into a strong tie, you need a place that essentially have a common interest for your for you and the those people that you're trying to develop the relationship with,
yeah.
Right? So, and that's typically what we call a community, right? A community is where you develop weak ties into strong ties. And we have many community in our life. You know, we, you know, for example, you know, if you go to school, right, this the campus is a natural community, right? If you live in a small town, right, that little city or town is a natural community where you could develop, you know, weak ties into strong tie, right? And so those are places where you develop weak ties into strong tie. It's essentially a community where you have some common interest.
Hmm.
But where do you kind of maintain the strong tie after you have developed them? Right. So that is where social network comes in.
Yeah.
Right? Social network is actually where you maintain your strong tie. Right. So if you look at your personal relationship, for example, if you look at your Facebook, right? If you look at every one of your friends on Facebook,
yeah.
Right? You actually share some common community with them in the past.
Mm.
Right. So for example, you know, some of your friends you may know, you know, because you go to the same college together, you know, you have the, you work in the same company together. So those are the community in which you develop the weak ties into a strong tie.
Mm.
And that's why they are maintained in your social network today.
So that's that kind of the offline foundation, and then you create, what you embellish or deepen the relationship in online communities.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this notion of a community and social network, they actually exist, you know, in the offline world way before the online counterpart, right? So, I mean, we human is actually our social animals, mm-hmm. right? So we actually have communities and have social network embedded in our social structure. And basically, I think social media, you know, like, you know, such as communities and social network actually come in much later in the game, and essentially to help us, you know, augment the fact that we are kind of spatially dispersed, and
yeah.
we don't have, we cannot be at the same place at the same time all the time. So it helps us communicate better.
So in terms of if you're a company or a brand or a business, and you're trying to create this sense of connection to deepen your relationship with customers. In your experience, what are things that people have done to do that work really well?
Yeah, so I think, you know, like I said, you know, if you're trying to build, engage customer in the short term,
yeah,
you could pretty much do it any way you want, right? You could just, you know, send them interesting stuff, you know, a joke every day, right? And that will work. But the challenge is, how do you build a strong relationship such that your engagement is long term?
Yeah.
So that's quite challenging. Right. And typically, a company who does this well focuses on the four kind of fundamental components of a relationship. And those are basically time,
mm-hmm.
Intensity, trust, and reciprocity.
Right.
Okay. So these are the four components of a relationship. Right? So if you're able to kind of spend a lot of time with the person, right, and have this strong emotional intensity for that person, and then have trust for that person, build trust, and then have reciprocity, you know, between you and that person. So essentially helping each other, right? Then essentially you will end up with a strong relationship, because those are the four fundamental components, right? Mm. So different people may have different kind of, I would say that the biggest component may be different, right? For example, like I may see my colleague a lot, you know, I see him every day,
yeah.
but I may not have the strong emotional intensity with them as with my relative, right? So for example, like I may have a cousin that I don't see every day, you know, because, you know, he or she kind of live far away, but then because they're my relative, I have a much stronger kind of emotional intensity
yeah.
for that person.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, so that's, you know, company that build relationship well with their customers tend to focus on, you know, spending the time with their customer when they want to spend time with you, and right? So that's the first component, the time component, right? And they try to, you know, do something that their customer really have strong emotional attachment with. For example, you know, something that they care about, right? For example, being a green company, being environmentally conscious, like supporting cancer research, all these great things that a lot of people have strong emotional kind of, you know, that people feel strongly about, right? If they do that, then, you know, they're going to start to elicit some of these emotional attachment with their customers. And finally, you know, a third thing, not final yet. So trust is where, you know, social media can really help, right?
Yeah.
So a company that leverages social media to kind of essentially create a transparent environment between the company and the customer, and also among the customer, tend to build trust that way, right? Because, you know, transparency is essentially the critical. It's critical to building trust, right?
Yeah.
If I can tell you everything about myself, you know, I'm completely transparent to you, then that means I really trust you, right? So, and if you do the same thing, then, you know, we basically build this trust for each other, right? So companies who are more willing to tell the customer about, you know, how they operate, you know, some of the stuff that's typically hidden inside the wall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now with social media, you can actually tell your customer more about yourself. It could be essentially be more human about it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you also allow that transparency among the customers, right? So a customer, you know, can learn about how other customers feel and think about your company,
yeah,
right? Then that's also very helpful to building trust as well.
So kind of like comments and ratings being transparent so people can see the negative and the positive reviews.
Yeah, that's one way, right? Mm. So that's definitely, that's in fact, you know, that's pretty much all social media channel will help, you know, like with this, you know, it's because social media is all about like peer-to-peer interaction and also, you know, you as a company engage with your customer as well. So if you do that in a way that's authentic and transparent, then pretty much, you know, any channel will work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, some channel may be more appropriate for a particular type of industry or a particular brand, but if you do that, the key is really to be authentic and be transparent, right? And if you do that, customer will eventually figure it out, you know, that you are a truly a transparent company.
Mm.
They would build trust with you, right? And finally, is this notion of reciprocity, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so reciprocity is kind of strange because a lot of companies don't kind of misses a very important point about reciprocity is that they forget to let their customer help them.
Oh, that's right? A good point, actually.
Yeah, because you know, we kind of know this intuitively between you know, human to human, peer to peer relationship. You know, we know that if you have a relationship where one person invests all the time and all the energy into building this relationship, then that relationship is actually not as strong as if both parties invest the time and effort.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to customer to brand relationship, right? And brands typically forget about that. You know, they typically think about, oh, I have to serve my customer. I have to help them and meet their needs. No, that's true, right? But that's only one side of the equation, right? In terms of building a stronger relationship, you have to also let them invest a little bit in the company, right? Let them help you, right? Let them, you know, answer other people's questions, help you create a better product, right? Co-create with you, right? So that's essentially the key to building this cycle of reciprocity, essentially co-creation.
That's amazing because, you do often just forget about that.
Yeah. It's true. A lot of people forget about that.
Sorry, I interrupted you mid-flow. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say that a lot of people forget about letting their customer help them, even though we know, you know, that's how we build stronger relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So when companies are, you know, I guess one of the reasons is because a lot of companies are very transactional focused, right?
Mm-hmm.
They focus on transaction. Once you finish that transaction, then that's the end of it. They don't think about building a long-term relationship with their customer.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why they don't think about it. If they start thinking in that way, right, a customer is a long-term relationship, then, you know, maybe more company will start, you know, start essentially apply some of these knowledges we have between human relationships to business, right? So, and in that sense, I think it would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think it's true. And it's really is a blind spot. Cause I was, as you were saying that, I was kind of grinning to myself thinking how I still feel quite uncomfortable asking customers or people who've bought the book, you know, readers or followers to give me feedback. And it's one of those things where I wouldn't think twice about asking a friend, because obviously I like to help my friends and it gives me pleasure to help other people as well. But receiving help, I wonder if there's some interesting psychology about receiving as well, because it's, you know, and often people are really, really helpful. So just asking, can you give me feedback on who I should interview next, or what you would do differently about the newsletter? And you can get some extraordinarily open and useful feedback, but it's so fascinating. Reciprocity, thank you. So some of our listeners will be familiar with Dunbar's number, which is something that's a really fascinating area, especially with social. But for those who aren't, can you tell us a little bit about what it is and whether you think it still applies online?
Yeah, so the Dunbar number is basically, a number that characterizes the number of meaningful relationships that you can have with people.
Yes.
Right. So it Dunbar actually studies primates, and he extrapolated, his results from studying the primate brain size, the size of their neocortex, and their group size. Mm. Right? So he extrapolated that and then say, well, since we know how big the human brain is, I should be able to know what's the ideal group size for humans.
Right? Yeah.
So that turns out to be somewhere around 150, right? It's 148, but people just round it up to 100.
Yeah.
So that's basically how many meaningful relationships you can maintain, right? So that's, when social media comes along, that's kind of a little bit strange, because, a lot of people essentially have, 500 friends, or some celebrities, you may even have, 1,000 friends, or so are those really friends? Are those really meaningful relationships? It turns out that, what Dunbar basically says that, you can't, you cannot actually have more friends than 150. And if you do, then you are actually making some trade-off. Either that means your what you call, a friend is really a weaker form of friend, right? Or you have fewer number of strong ties, right? Mm. In that sense, like, because your attention and time is kind of essentially drawn by these weaker ties to kind of build relationship, right? So you don't have as much time and attention to kind of maintain your strong one, right? So, and we kind of see that in our life as well, in the sense that, for example, in the pre-industrial age, where Dunbar actually surveyed some of his some of the pre-industrial tribe and villages, he found that it's actually not exactly 150, but on average they do come out to be 150. Like the average tribe size, like big families, they actually do fall in the ballpark of 150.
Fascinating.
So it's actually fascinating to me as well. It's kind of surprising to see that, there's actually a consistency in how, many people that you can actually have a meaningful relationship with.
So how does this play out online then, do you think?
It means that even though we can have more than 100, right, we're actually making some trade-off with the strong ties that really means much more to us, right? We're either taking some of the attention and time that we normally allocate it to our strong ties and give it to our weaker ties to maintain those, weaker form of relationship, right?
Yeah.
Or we just have fewer strong ties, right? So like I was going to say that, in the pre-industrial age, children typically live with their parents all their life, and they, parents know everything about their kids and kids know everything about their parents, right? So that's actually a very strong tie. You could say it's natural, right? But so today, what happens? We don't live with our parents, anymore. And, some of us still do, but not everyone. Most people probably don't. And then we barely even talk to our parents sometimes. So even though we still call our parents strong tie, our family, right? They are family, so they had to be our strong tie. But this sense of a strong tie, this, the notion of a strong tie today with our parents, it's actually become a lot weaker than it was, you know, than in the time where, you know, in the pre-industrial ages where children actually live with their parent all their life.
Yeah.
So even though we still call them strong, it's actually become weaker. Our notion, our strong tie has steadily become weaker. And that's why we actually are able to maintain more friends kind of in our relationship today. You know, like we, you know, because we're actually taking away some of the time and attention that we normally allocated to our strong ties, such as parents, right? And then we give it to those, our friends, a weaker time.
Oh, that's so sad in a way, because if we stretch the elastic too thin, well, do you think that that can happen, that we can stretch ourselves too thinly between a whole host of weak ties?
I think it definitely can. I think it can happen. Because I think fundamentally, based on Dunbar's work, right, he basically used like our brain size, right, to kind of as a predictor to predict how many kind of relationship that we can have. So you know, if you look at it that way, then you know our brain size haven't really changed for you know almost a millennia, right?
Yeah,
or thousands of years. So, so our capacity, our kind of mental capacity to kind of process all the, you know, the relationships, then it becomes, it's a limited resource, right?
Yeah.
So we can't really divert all of our attention everywhere because we simply can't do that. You know, we cannot listen to two people talk about their life, you know, their troubles at once, you know, because we need a devoted attention to listen to them, and we need time to spend with that person, right? So we only have 24 hours a day. We only have so much attention. So that's a limited resource. You know, that's more like you know physics, right? You can't overcome that unless you build a time machine.
Well, I think there's something in that as well. For I don't know. At least I've certainly felt this way, that the more people that you allow to occupy your headspace and maybe your feelings, the harder it is to keep track, and the more shallowly the relationship fulfills you, I think. I don't know. Okay, wonderful. So I'm now going to go into something completely different, a little quick fire round of five questions where it's an either or answer. Are you ready for a little game?
Okay.
So cat or dog?
Cat or dog? Dog.
Personalization or privacy?
Personalization.
Relative or absolute?
Relative.
Certainty or adventure?
Certainty or adventure. Adventure, of course.
And present or future?
That's a hard one.
No,
I have to say future. Oh. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. Well, Michael, thank you so much for delving deeply with us today about you know, science of relationships and sustained engagement. And for everyone listening, if you'd like to tweet to Michael or ask him any questions, you can find him. Actually, Michael, what is your it's Michael8EL. I'm gonna tweet it, write it down in the show notes because it's a little bit of a funny spelling. So it's at MICH8, the number 8, EL Wu. I'm gonna put your website and your LinkedIn profile up as well as a link for Lithium and your ebooks, which are fantastic. Is there anything else that you think people should check out, or is that pretty much it?
Yeah, I think that's a good starting point.
Wonderful.
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is Michael Wu with the A replaced by the number 8, because Michael Wu is actually too common of a name. It's taken.
All right. See, the way you explain it, it's so much easier cognitively instead of me spelling the whole thing out. Wonderful. Well, yeah. Michael, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure talking with you today.
No, it's my pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you like this episode, make sure you go to my website, thewebpsychologist.com/show-notes, to get links to all the resources we mentioned, as well as updates on future shows. Thanks for listening.